This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Stephen Blue. He is the author of, well, several books, but his newest one, I believe, is Metamorphosis, where he talks about turning Rust Belt companies into high-tech powerhouses. And this has broad implications for the economy as we see wealth migration occur due to trade wars, tariffs, taxation in high-tax jurisdictions like my home state of California. I think this will be a fascinating discussion. Stephen is an internationally recognized expert in transforming these companies and talking about the implications to the broader economy. Stephen, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Yeah, it's good to have you on. And you're coming to us from Minnesota, is that correct?
Minnesota, yep.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, America has changed so much since we have seen globalization really have a largely devastating effect on the American worker and many American companies. However, it did bring us a lot of cheap stuff you can buy at the store, that's for sure. And I don't know if that trade was worth it, actually. But take us through kind of, you know, any insights into what has happened in the Rust Belt. I mean, everybody knows the broad picture, of course. In Allentown, they're closing all the factories down, right? But there's obviously more to it than that. Give us kind of a view of that and, you know, what can be done about it.
Sure. Well, manufacturers have gone out of business in droves in the last, it's been a long time. If you reach back into the 70s, and I've been around a while, so I've had experience of this. You reach back to the 70s and all the manufacturers moved their operations down to South Carolina or somewhere in the South from wherever it was, Michigan or Ohio, whatever. And that was okay for a while because we were chasing cheap labor and it was cheaper in the South in the 70s. And then in the 80s, it wasn't so cheap in the South anymore. So then we started chasing cheap labor in Mexico. And then we started chasing cheap labor in South Vietnam and other parts of the world. And eventually, manufacturers got to the point where they couldn't chase cheap labor anymore. And everything was being equalized to the point that you just mentioned about the globalization. Everything got equalized, and then you're on an equal playing field with somebody who pays their employees, I don't know, $2 a day, $1.50 a day, or whatever. And I tell people all the time, you can't out-cheap the Chinese. And so now they're in a place with the global trade wars where they're going out of business because they cannot afford to produce a product anymore because they can't match the cheapest countries in the world. That's the state of play right now. And it doesn't get better. It only gets worse. Okay, fine. You know, Trump is, you know, trying to equalize the playing field. And, you know, we're, in a play trade war with China to try to equalize the trade deficits. Who knows how that'll turn out because you get puts and calls. I can tell you, as an example, Jason, in my business, I benefited from the trade tariffs that were put on China, and I've heard from some of them, and I'm not sure if it's an even score, but it's a very complicated picture.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, look, philosophically, I love to say I'm a libertarian and I believe in free trade because the benefits are sometimes rather counterintuitive. I mean, we had this kind of xenophobia back in the late 80s when it came to Japan. And, you know, then it was China and other low-cost jurisdictions. But in a lot of ways, Americans benefit from that stuff, for sure, because, you know, the price of consumer products is just plummeted. It's mind-boggling to think of what it costs to buy a new house and furnish it or buy any high-tech products in the 90s versus today. You know, it's really not that much time has passed. You know, it's a lot of time, but it's not much time at the same time. But I just don't think you can really have free trade when the parties, the trading partners, aren't equally yoked. When you're allowed to pollute, you don't have OSHA, you don't have minimum wage, you don't have the rules that our companies are burdened with over here. They just can't do it. I mean, you got to have some control. That control is usually called a tariff.
Well, you make a good point, you know, about environmental controls and labor and wage restrictions that we have that other countries don't have. And so your point is, and I agree with it, by the way, is there can never be equal and even trading between partners that have different, you know, as you called it, yokes. China pollutes the atmosphere all over the place, and they're not going to stop that. And so let's assume for a minute that, okay, if I send a car to China, there is a 10% tariff. Name any number you want. China, you send a car to the United States, 10% tariff. That's so-called even trade, right? But it really isn't even, because the factors of production that the Chinese have are a whole lot cheaper than ours. And so pound for pound, they're going to be more prosperous when they make that trade than we will. That's the point you just made.
Yeah, absolutely. So the playing field is unlevel. I think everybody gets that. The trading partners are not equally yoked. And the funny thing is, just to mention, you know, in the news coverage, it's so slanted against the Trump administration.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, every article you see is about how the costs are going to go up, the costs are going to go up. You never see an article. I mean, and when I say never, it's of course a figure of speech. I'm sure there's a couple of them out there. So listeners, do not send me all the articles that, you know, I'm sure there's a few there. Okay, I get it. It's a figure of speech. But you basically never see an article that says, hey, jobs are coming back to America. You know, what happened to all those high-paying jobs that we used to have in, you know, the post-World War II era? You don't see anything about that. And so I don't love what he's doing in a lot of ways, but I think it has to be done. And it's going to spur the Chinese to compete on a more level playing field, and the other countries as well. So talk about it domestically. You started off with that, actually, Stephen, when you talked about how, you know, we saw this sort of movement, and I'll even say it was the movement of companies to the right to work states. It was the unions that pushed them off first, you know, and Detroit, the poster child for big city failure in America, is probably the world. It's just the poster child. I mean, the unions and a bunch of corrupt Democratic mayors and so forth just pushed the business out of Detroit. I mean, that was a flagship city years ago, and now it's a disaster. And they went to the South. They went to the right-to-work states, you know, these auto manufacturers and so forth. What's going on domestically a little more? Just unpack that a little more for us, if you would.
You know, what happens now is the states have sort of, I won't say equalized wages and working conditions among each other, because California is like way out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm doing some work for a big life safety contract out in California. And when I send my people there, I have to pay my people what the prevailing wage is in California, which is nuts. It's absolutely nuts. And so the problem that I run into is, let's say I'm paying my guys, just pick a number, I don't know, $20 an hour. I have to pay them $50 an hour when they're working in California.
Hey, but wait, it's worse than that. Look at, you know, I still have three companies in California, even though I don't live there anymore. I happen to be here now. I'm in San Diego, but I don't have to pay taxes here because I'm not a resident anymore, thankfully. And, you know, it's just every time you do business around the country, it's always two states. Of course, there are more, but two main ones that there's all these special rules and different regulatory burdens you have to comply with. And it's, guess what? California and New York. You know, it's not just the wages. It's a zillion other regulations.
Oh, God, yes. I know. It's absolutely crazy.
It's nuts.
And so, okay, so fine, I have to pay $50 an hour. I don't like that. I build that into the contract, right? I mean, but if I'm competing against a California company that's already at that wage level, I'm sort of impaired. But the real problem is I bring that employee back to Minnesota. Let's say he's working out there for 6 months at $50 an hour. Guess what he's going to do? He's going to build into his budget and his lifestyle $50 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Then he comes back to Minnesota and he's back to $20 an hour. And it's like, you know, kind of been screwed here. You name the two biggest offenders are New York and California. They think they can dictate for the entire country. But if you look at the heartland of the United States, and the basic staple still is manufacturing. Okay, we're in a service economy. I get that. In some of our, Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and some of the other companies are higher technology. But the mainstay of the United States still is manufacturing. And the problem is manufacturing is eroding every single day. But here's where the problem is, Jason. As I tell people this all the time. It's eroding because of what I call fat, dumb, and happy CEOs.
Okay, tell us about that.
A fat, dumb, and happy CEO is a guy, probably, you know, he's maybe early 60s, late 50s, been around a while, you know, doesn't like, you know, millennials because they ask for too much and sort of got, you know, his own way to look at the world. But what he's looking at is he wants to coast until retirement. and he doesn't want to do anything different. He doesn't want to do anything radical. He doesn't want to shake up, upset the shareholders. He doesn't want to have the board questioning what he's doing. And then what happens? He refuses to do all that. Company slides into decline, but it's a slow decline. Every year, the margins get a little less from the year before. The year after that, they get a little less. Then all of a sudden, the alarm bells start going off, and he goes, oh, man, I'm in real trouble here. I got to do something in a hurry. But it's too late because he's already squandered all of his profits that he could have used on new product development and new marketing initiatives and so forth.
Well, what you're describing applies to an even much greater degree in government.
And, oh, God, yes.
And that's why it's so sad, because it's just everybody is concerned about what happens during their tenure, and that's about it.
The guy that they just had leading GE for a year or whatever, they bounced him out. It wasn't even because he told them the truth, told the board the truth about what was happening, right, and what Immelt had put together. But this guy, you know, he's the poor sucker that got put in the job to fix it. Mm-hmm. And then they fired him because they didn't like what he told them.
Yeah.
That's a key point, because boards and shareholders don't like to be told there's something wrong.
Right. Yeah.
What they want you to tell them all the time is that everything's going to be fine. So therefore, that's what CEOs do. Everything's fine, board. Everything's fine, board. Everything's fine, board, until you can't deny it or hide it anymore, and then disaster strikes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so what does that mean to us? You started off in saying that it's all definitely true about California, and we were talking about the kind of the geography of this wealth migration.
First of all, I don't do business in either one of those states unless I absolutely have to. I mean, and what does that say for wealth creation in the future, wealth creation in those states? Those states at some point, and now that, you know, you can't deduct income tax at the level you could before, and property taxes, what's going to happen to those states? At some point in time, they're going to be not able to sustain themselves, because people like you have already left. Large corporations will leave as soon as they can, and at some point in time, they sort of implode. So I think wealth migration is going to keep going to Florida. Arizona, I understand, is kind of a hybrid. The taxes aren't too bad. They aren't zero, but they aren't too bad.
Yeah, but they're zero in Nevada.
They're zero in Nevada. They're zero in Texas. But like you say, Texas has got an awful property tax rate.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that's funny, I mean, it's not really that bad in Texas in terms of property taxes, because California actually has very low property taxes, thanks to Howard Jarvis back in the late 70s and Prop 13. But now they're trying to overturn that, and I don't know what the latest on that debate is. I didn't follow it too closely. But that's going to really kill California real estate if Prop 13 gets overturned. My God, that'll be a mess.
Oh, I bet.
But, you know, Washington State has no state income taxes. But, you know, it's so left-wing up there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, especially Seattle, you just nobody can do business there anymore. The restaurants are... I mean, there's debate about this stuff, but, you know, I remember I took one of my groups, my mastermind group, to Seattle for a weekend retreat. And at every restaurant where I'm paying the check for the entire group, you know, dinner, lunches, whatever, they had surcharges on the checks for the minimum wage increase. You know, they just have to, of course, everything passes through. That's what these politicians just don't realize. They act as though the market will not react. And of course the market reacts. It all passes through. And companies are just pass-through entities. They don't pay. The boards of directors and CEOs, they don't take pay cuts. They simply pass things through to either shareholders or customers or employees. You know, they're going to pass it through to one of those three stakeholders or vendors.
They do. Absolutely, they do. And, you know, Seattle's a very unfriendly business environment, and they've driven companies out of there in droves. And then at some point in time, they'll wake up and they'll go, oh, my God, we got no tax base left here anymore. What do we do now?
Yeah. It's interesting, too, how hypocritical the technology companies are. You know, many of them are, of course, based in Silicon Valley. Amazon just announced its two candidates, neither of which were very tax-friendly or business-friendly places. But the reality is they play so many games because, you know, they'll have, like, what do they call it, the double Irish twist or something, right? They'll have, you know, some Irish company own their intellectual property and it'll be offshore so they won't have to pay tax on it and they can keep that money out of the U.S. It's just disgusting the way they're so hypocritical. But the manufacturing companies, where they can't play those games as well, at least not as well, and we're going to get to the segue here about your newest, your book, Metamorphosis, they're stuck, right? Because they're not playing the game. They're just traditional businesses with a physical location, and they can't play the games that Apple can play and Facebook can play and Amazon can play, where they get the benefit of living in these high-tax jurisdictions, but they don't really pay their fair share.
No, because they move their money around wherever it needs to be, the most tax-efficient havens in the world. That only goes so far. GE used to play that game pretty well, and then it sort of caught up to them in the last couple of years. But you just look at Amazon, you know, they're getting $2 billion worth of government subsidies to make this move. And Amazon, one of the richest companies in the world, Bezos, one of the richest guys in the world, he could write a check for $2 billion and it would be like a rounding error for him. So why in the devil is the taxpayer, if this is your point, why in the devil is the taxpayer paying all that?
It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the similar kind of hypocrisy to, you know, Warren Buffett's constant statements about my secretary pays higher taxes than me. Well, you know, the IRS will accept more if you just give them more money. They won't turn it down.
And yet
Warren Buffett, at least was, I'm not sure of the outcome of it, was in this giant litigation with the IRS where he was suing them and disputing his taxes. Why doesn't he just pay more? You know, he keeps saying everybody should pay more. Why doesn't he?
Yeah, why don't you just pay more then, Warren?
Yeah, he's a hypocrite just like all the rest of them. But is there an answer for these businesses that are more traditional type, what you call Rust Belt businesses? Can they play, at least in part, can they play in the game that these high-tech companies play, where they can change the sort of the nature, the complexion of their company and their profit centers?
They can't play the tax haven game. You got to be mega big to be able to do that, and they shouldn't even try it. But they should focus on, CEOs hate it when I tell them this, because I tell them all the time, it's the first thing you got to focus on is changing your culture. And then they go, oh, no, don't talk to me about culture. That's the, you know, squishy, free pizza and beer for lunch crowd. No, it's not. If you want to have a culture by design and not by default, that's what most companies have. You don't have to be a manufacturing Rust Belt company. Most companies have a culture by default. And the CEOs don't know what their culture is. They think they do, but they don't. Here's a perfect example. Wells Fargo got a really crappy culture. But, you know, if you go to their website, look at their values, they have something like, well, we value our customer, we put our customer first, and we're credible, honest people, whatever. And it's
I'm so glad you mentioned Wells Fargo. I was their customer for over 20 years. Big customer, private bankers. They are disgusting. That is a disgusting company at every level. I mean, I guess it used to be okay, but in the past few years, it's like they have a scandal every month. It's mind-boggling. Ripping people off left and right, you know. They got to be right now the most hated big bank in America. I mean, you know, for a while it was B of A, and then it was Chase with the robo-signing scandal where they're spending exactly 14 seconds reviewing and before they foreclose on people during the Great Recession. But Wells takes the cake right now. Yeah.
United Airlines is almost as guilty. They have what I call bumper sticker values.
Yeah.
These are values that look good on the corporate wall and in the boardroom, but they don't practice them and they don't. But I'll tell you what, the CEO of Wells Fargo, before he got fired, I bet you he really believed those bumper sticker values on the wall. Mm-hmm. And so therefore he said, well, like every time United Airlines employee does something stupid, the CEO defends them because they have a set of values that's truth, justice, and the American way too. And so every time they do something that stupid, the CEO refuses to believe it was the employee's fault. It has to be the customer's fault because of the values we have. And that's the place I tell CEOs to turn first. If you want to change your company, you want to transform your company, you want to move it from meager earnings to mega earnings, you got to take a look at your culture first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so just give us the quick tip on culture, and then let's move on to some of these hidden assets that businesses have. And this applies to everybody listening who has really any kind of small business. It's kind of amazing how there are assets that a lot of these entrepreneurs, they're just not even thinking of. They're not even recognizing them really as assets.
The quick tip on culture is I tell people the kind of culture you want to model is the Cirque du Soleil. Have you ever seen a Cirque du Soleil performance, Jason?
Yeah, I've seen a few of them. What is that? What do you mean?
Well, Cirque du Soleil performers come to work every day all jazzed up and all energized and all excited to do better today than they performed yesterday. And then I tell CEOs all the time, wouldn't you want a culture that's all jazzed up to perform better today than they did yesterday? And then they go, oh, no, you don't understand. We're not performers. people have to work in a factory, you know, it's burdensome, it's dirty work and all that kind of stuff. And I say, that's all true. And if people are totally turned off by what they're doing, whose fault is that? It's yours. So I say the model you want to keep in mind is Cirque du Soleil. That's what you work toward. Now, that ain't easy, but I've done it and I've shown people how to do it all the time.
Okay, so I just thought you were going to say they're really flexible. Ha ha. Bad joke.
That's a good one. I'm going to use that next time.
Okay, so what's next, though? What assets should people be looking at that they're maybe not considering to be assets?
Well, the first thing you want to look at, particularly if you're a manufacturer, is what kind of inventory are you sitting on that you could convert into cash? And I walked into a company once, Jason, that had $2 million. This is real money now, $2 million worth of work in process inventory, somewhere between raw and work in process, that was just sitting in the factory. And I asked them, I said, why are you keeping $2 million worth of that inventory here? Well, because if the supplier goes out of business, then we wouldn't have any raw material. Okay. Did you think about qualifying another supplier or two? Well, no. And so I got them to qualify another supplier, and then they were able to liquidate almost that $2 million that put money in their coffers so they could use that for new product development. They could use it for marketing initiatives, for all kinds of things. So that's the first thing I tell people. Look at what you've got and trap value in the business, and inventory is probably your first place to start.
Okay, what about intellectual property?
That's a little more difficult. A lot, especially Rust Belt companies, they don't have much of that. That's the problem. And you know how you evaluate intellectual property and what you do with it is, you know, if you have a patent that's issued that has value in a product that you're selling, you could use that to your advantage if you wanted to by licensing it to somebody else, by co-branding it with somebody else, all kinds of things you could do if you have a patent and you have sales and it's recognized in the marketplace. If you just have intellectual property sitting on the books, it's just really not worth much.
Okay, so you talk about disruptional positioning, branding, and marketing. What do you mean by
yep.
that?
I love that because, you know, if you come out with a new product, here's what I say. If you release a new product that's completely different than anything you've ever done before, which is what you ought to be doing, don't do brand extensions, don't keep doing the same thing you did yesterday. But if you do a new product completely different than you've ever done before, what I call new to the world products, you can't market that product unless you disrupt the marketplace, particularly if you disrupt your competition. And you can't disrupt your competition with new products if you go to the market with the same old marketing clothes that you went to yesterday. I give you a perfect example. Most manufacturers, well, how they market their product, they take out four-color full-page ads in the trade pubs that don't say a damn thing other than, you know, we're the best and you should buy our stuff. And then they go to trade shows. If you've ever been to a manufacturing trade show, you know that there are more competitors in the hall than there are customers. And that's just a tired old way of doing it. And believe it or not, a lot of manufacturers aren't going to market with today's tools. And you know what today's tools are. It's social media.
Okay. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, we do go to trade shows still, but we don't do it the old way. What we do is we have a very attractive woman walks the halls and gets people to come into our booth. Because if you've ever been to a trade show, customers don't want to come into your booth. They don't want to get trapped there. Right. They don't want to, you know, have to answer questions and feel on the spot there. And the sales guys usually stand there in front so no one could get in there if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. So we have a very attractive woman, bring them into the booth, and then we sit them down with a branded pair of headphones and an iPad, and we have them watch a short and give them a drink of water, have them watch a very short video of what our newest product is like that we want them to know about. After they've seen the video, on their way out, I've got a professional camera crew standing outside that gets their reaction to our newest product, which is invariably positive. It's not positive, we just don't use it. Then we start incorporating that into our marketing materials. But those are the kind of things that manufacturers have to do different. They can't go to the market with the same old marketing clothes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's circle back, if we can, to kind of the opening conversation here of what does this mean to the economy and the way this wealth is moving around the country? I mean, it sounds like we would both agree, maybe not, but you know, feel free to disagree, that the action is moving out of the high-cost, high-tax states more into Midwest and the southeastern United States. Is that the long-term view of this?
Yeah, I think so, because I don't see any, you know, even medium-term fixes to that problem, because structurally, you know, the governments would have to change and the tax structures would have to change. And I'm sure you'd agree with me on this. governments and tax structures change at a glacial pace.
Oh, yeah. Very, very, very slowly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Interesting stuff. Stephen, give out your website.
StephenLBlue.com. That's StevenLBlue.com. You can find out all you want to know about me, and anything that you want to buy from me is all there.
Do you want to mention some of your other book titles just quickly? Because you've got a fairly diverse set of titles.
The first two were more or less labor of loves. The third one was called American Manufacturing 2.0, What Went Wrong and How to Make It Right. That was picked up by a big publishing house, and it has a lot of history and a lot of prescriptions for the future. My fourth book I co-wrote with Jack Daniels. Some people are familiar with him. Excuse me, Jack.
Jack Canfield.
Jack Canfield. I was having Jack Daniels when I wrote the book.
Maybe you were. Yeah, like, a lot of writers like their Jack Daniels.
I'm a vodka man. But anyway, that's called Mastering the Art of Success. That came out about 2 years ago. And then, of course, we were just talking about my fifth book. And I'm working on my sixth one, but I haven't gotten a publisher yet on that, so I probably shouldn't talk much about it.
Yeah, and Jack Canfield's been on the show a couple of times. You know, he was one of the co-editors of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, good stuff. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.